greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin with a special Labor Day edition of the MERS Monday podcast featuring the president of AFL-CIO of Michigan, Ron Bieber. Thanks for joining us again on Labor Day.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Well, I wanted to get your impressions on President Trump and how he's doing with your members. Obviously, he's been trying to appeal, I think, to that blue-collar worker, and I want to get the sense from you on what you're hearing from your members on whether they think that the president is doing right by them.
Well, when President Trump got elected, I said right off the bat, we're going to call honest balls and strikes on him. And, you know, he said a lot of great things during the last election campaign. He hasn't followed through on them, and our members are seeing that. Infrastructure, he's now in his third year. He was the president that knew how to build things. There's been no infrastructure bill or anything that he's passed in Congress. You haven't heard about the wall in quite a while. He was going to build the wall, but you haven't heard about that lately. But putting the wall aside, I mean, he talked about building roads and bridges and airports and hospitals and all sorts of stuff, and you just haven't seen it. So I would say our members have come to full grips with that they can't trust what he says. Now going into another election cycle, I think our members have wised up that his actions don't meet his rhetoric.
So what do they think of the trade policies, and what do you think of the trade policies? Because he's trying to get tough on China. He's trying to renegotiate NAFTA so America and Michigan get a better deal. They have to appreciate that, right?
Again, if the actions met the rhetoric, with NAFTA, we have suffered more than any other state in this country under NAFTA. 25 years now, we've lost 168,000 manufacturing jobs in Michigan alone, over a million throughout the country due to NAFTA. Now, down the street, they're trying to work out a budget. Imagine if we had 168,000 good-paying manufacturing jobs in this state still. What amount of revenue would that bring in? Maybe we wouldn't be scrambling to find revenue for roads and education. But putting that aside, I'll give him credit that he said that NAFTA was a bad deal for America, and it was. But again, he was going to have that done in 100 days. 100 days came and went, and nothing was done on NAFTA. He's trying now, but as it stands, again, his actions don't meet his rhetoric. The deal as it stands right now, we couldn't support. It's good for business, but not good for working people in the U.S. And if it doesn't change, there's time to change it, and hopefully they will. Kyle, there's nothing I'd rather do than support a good trade deal for American workers, but the labor rights aren't in there, the enforcement mechanisms aren't in there, and this deal they cut for Big Pharma that gives them a decade of monopoly over the prices on pharmaceuticals, all the problems we've got with health care in this country, nothing is worse than the outrageous price of pharmaceuticals, and you're not going to do anything meaningful there unless you get a handle on that. It has to be a good deal for the workers in all three countries. Mexican workers have to have labor rights where they can organize and bargain for better wages, and it's not there. The enforcement piece, if there's no teeth in any sort of enforcement policies, I don't care what words you got on paper in that agreement, it's not worth the paper it's written on. And as it stands right now, we'd have to work to kill it. I'd much rather work to support a good deal that's good for American workers and would be glad to do it if they fix it.
Now, what about China? Because it looks like President Trump is the first president in a long time to be tough on China. What do you think of what he's doing there?
I really don't know what to think. I'll put it this way. I think he's in over his head. The tariffs that he put on, I mean, tariffs are a tool. They're not an overall strategic plan to deal with a trading partner. They're a tool. And I think it's gotten away from him, out of control. I just don't think he knows what he's doing enough to be handling it all, comprehensive strategy. I'll give him credit. China needs to be dealt with. The currency manipulation and things that they've done to us to take advantage of us have been around for a long time, and he took it on. I wish he had a better handle on it, or maybe was better equipped to take the problem on. I don't think our members trust him to be able to see it through. It's dangerous. When you start a trade war like that, it's dangerous business, and it could have big implications. I hope it works out the best for Americans.
And we're taping a little earlier in the week, so we don't know if anyone has dropped out yet. But as of today, there's 21 presidential candidates on the Democratic side. Has there been any that have impressed you, and who are you hearing the most excitement over?
A lot of them have impressed me. Frankly, I think any one of them in there would be a better solution to Americans' problems than President Trump. And I'll say that flat out off the bat. Now, it's so early, Kyle, that, I mean, there's some of them that I've sat down and met with over the past that I'm really impressed with, and I'm not going to tell you who because I don't want to name names. It's too early in the process. I think it'll weed itself out. By the time it gets to Michigan, I think the field will be narrowed dramatically, would be my guess, and we'll be looking at maybe a handful by that time. There's good candidates. There's great candidates, and we'll let the process work itself out. And the AFL has a national process that they use to do endorsements. We don't play a great role in that. The national affiliated unions do. So when the time comes, I'm sure wise decisions will be made and we'll be full bore into a 2020 election cycle.
Let's turn our attention now to the state and the issues that we have here in state government. First of all, I want to get your impressions how you think Gretchen Whitmer's done as governor.
Gretchen's doing great. I'll give her credit right out of the chute. She put a bold plan on to fix the damn roads, like she said, and fund education. That wasn't easy. That was a hard move to make, I would think, to go out and finally show people the entire scope of the problem and have a plan to fix it. Now, I don't know where it's going to end up. Everybody knows that the budget negotiations are stalled down there, or I say stalled. I say stalled because they took all summer off and didn't work on it, but they've got a little time. Everybody knows we need revenue. I mean, you unless you want to be driving on dirt roads out here, there's tools out there that will show you that the roads that are in fair condition now will be in poor condition in a short period of time. And if they don't do something down the street in the legislature, we're all going to be in a bigger pothole than we are now a few years from now. What I don't get is everybody's known this for 10 years at least, and nobody will deal with it. It's time for the legislators to do their job that they were elected to. I don't know what the solution is. Somewhere there needs to be new revenue. It doesn't have to be necessarily the governor's plan. They can craft some other plan, but everybody knows what needs to be done, and they need to do it.
Now, what do you think of where the governor is on the Line 5 issue and delaying this building of the tunnel under the Straits? Your members would like to see a tunnel under the Straits, I'm sure, wouldn't they?
Yeah. I've got friends in the environmental community that I've had discussions with us about. Obviously, the Building Trades Council here has a huge interest in this. I don't get it. I mean, there's a pipeline laying on the bottom of the lake bed up there. It's 60 years old. Something's got to be done. This tunnel seems like a perfect solution to me. I worked in Detroit for 25 years, walked from events at Coble Hall over to the Rensen hundreds and hundreds of times. There was one spot where you had a hard time crossing a little side street. It's where this little side street goes down to the tunnel that goes under the Detroit River over to Canada. You know why you had a hard time crossing the street?
Why is that?
Because so many cars use that tunnel. So if you can build a tunnel to drive cars under with people in the cars, I don't understand why it's not a reasonable solution to put a tunnel under that Great Lakes up there that would encase a pipeline. I just don't get it. So the building trades have taken the lead on this issue. We may weigh in sometime here in a bigger way, but I don't get it. I mean, I don't get why the tunnel isn't a reasonable solution. I know this. Our skilled tradespeople have the skills to be able to build a tunnel that would be safe and encase that pipeline, and we wouldn't have any worries.
I also wanted to ask your opinion on Dana Nessel, how she's doing as Attorney General. She's been extremely active in her first 7-8 months here in office, and obviously she's fighting the tunnel hammer and tong, but what do you think of her job overall?
Dana's been doing good. She's been doing exactly what she said she was going to do. She saw problems in this state, and she said she was going to not be shy about taking them on and fixing them, and she is all of that. She is not shy, and she's strong-willed, and she sees an issue that affects the people of this state. She's going to take it on. I'm not quite sure I'm on the same page with her with the tunnel, but if that's what she thought she had to do, then we just aren't going to agree on that one. But she's doing good. She's going to hold a press conference this week on wage theft here in this building, which is a great issue that's been going on for years. People have been deceptively losing pay, and she said, hey, I'm all in. And she's coming here to announce this week on actions that she's going to take on that. So she's been doing good.
And then I also wanted to ask you about the state of labor. This being Labor Day, where would you say the state of labor is right now in Michigan?
We're strong. I'll say this. It feels better in Michigan than it did. We got, over the past decade, we got slammed for 8 years, attack after attack after attack. The atmosphere is better. I mean, with Governor Whitmer and Dana Nessel as Attorney General and Benson as Secretary of State, you feel a little bit like you're not, you know, at least you got some backstops out there that if there are attacks, that we'll have friends in the fight with us in powerful positions. So it feels better. Now, I'll say this about Michigan as a whole. We talked about the national economy. In Michigan, there's 43% of the people in this state who are working people who still can't afford the basics that it takes just to survive. So we've got a lot of work to do to raise wages in this state and make things better for working families so that they have a fair shot at the American dream. When you're working full-time and you can't just afford housing, food, clothing, transportation, there's something wrong. And I mean, we need to fix the roads, we need good schools, and we need to tackle this wage inequality problem, not just in the state, but in the whole country. But it's a huge issue here. I don't know about the economy. I mean, you're starting to see signs, there's plant closings again and things like that, and talk of a recession. I hope that none of that happens and that things can happen that reverse this. Labor's more united now, I think, than they have been in a long, long time that I've seen. We just came through 8 years of fighting together every day, and now we see light at the end of the tunnel, and I think that we're ready to unite and make change.
You know, one thing that I noticed from doing the On This Day in Michigan history is how divided this state was 50, 60 years ago between labor and business. And you saw that in the crafting of the budget and how hard it was for Soapy Williams to get a budget through the Republican legislature and how they actually did have payless paydays and they did have some serious problems. Bills weren't paid and so on and so forth. And it doesn't feel like that tension is there as much. And I wanted to see if you're feeling that or if it's just being hidden. But is the division between labor and business as stark as it's been historically?
No, I wouldn't say that. We came through tough times, the 2009 recession, and even before that, there were labor struggles with business, and I think there was a realization a decade ago at least that, you know, we're in the same boat, so we have to do the best we can to oar the same way, or else we're not going to both prosper. I will say this in relation to the budget. Labor and business are both of the agreement that we need to raise revenue in this state. A good share of the problem is our political system, I think, and it drives division. I think we need to fix that. Overall, the mood between business and labor has improved dramatically, certainly since when I started. Now, mm-hmm. For those who can't see me, my hair is very gray now, and I'm more closer to the end of my career than I was at the beginning. When I started out, you fought every day. You fought just to fight, because that's what you thought you had to do. But over time, I think the global economy changed things and business and labor figured out that we have to find solutions where we can. And in a lot of times, it got to be more of a relationship of problem solving than fighting. You didn't fight just to fight anymore, let me put it that way. So I think the mood is a lot better than it was years ago, for sure. Now, if we have to fight, we're going to fight. I mean, there's times where you don't agree, and then you have your fight, but it's kind of like a marriage. I fight with my wife, too. Now, she's going to hear this, but but we always make up and realize that, you know, there's another day, and we're codependent on each other, so you make up and you move on.
Ron Beaver, he's the president of the AFL-CIO here in Michigan. Thanks for taking time today.
Thank you for having me, Kyle.
Now we're going to move into the constituent meeting that Representative Justin Amash out of Cascade Township in the 3rd Congressional District had this past week in Ionia. And we're going to play a clip of him talking about why he broke off as an independent and what the people at this town hall can do to break what he called a corrupt two-party system.
Right now, the entire government is run by basically three people: the President of the United States, the Speaker of the House, and the Senate Majority Leader. Of course, you got a Supreme Court, which serves as somewhat of a check. But for the most part, the active part of our government is run by just three people. And that's not the way it's supposed to work. We're supposed to have a very robust legislative process where hundreds of members of Congress can participate and offer their ideas, can affect the outcome, where we have debates and deliberation on things. And right now, that doesn't happen at all. The parties are controlling the system so much that you hardly have any debate in Congress. And most of the big pieces of legislation they go through are just run through the three people I mentioned. Sometimes they'll bring in a few other people, like you might have the minority leaders, you might have a few other members, but generally speaking, you can count on your fingers the number of people who are intimately involved in making decisions for our government. And that's not the way it's supposed to work at all. Over time, the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader have become more powerful. Right now, of course, you've got Mitch McConnell in the Senate, you've got Nancy Pelosi in the House, but this was true also when they had their predecessors. When we had Paul Ryan in the House or John Boehner in the House, the Speaker of the House has become extraordinarily powerful, and we all know Mitch McConnell basically runs the entire show in the Senate and controls the thing very tightly. Right now in the House, the Speaker of the House, whether it's Paul Ryan or Nancy Pelosi, can raise more money than the entire party combined, so whatever party they're in, the Speaker can raise more money than the entire party combined, and will dish out resources and promises and other things to keep people in line. And the problems start with this current generation of leaders, but it's gotten worse. And as the people at the top get more powerful, they get more powerful. The power begets power. Because as these leaders get more powerful, then the outside groups, lobbyists and others, and even the members of Congress, they start to recognize how powerful these leaders are, and they give them more power. They fall in line. And as they fall in line, it's harder to break from them. Right now, for example, the Speaker of the House can decide just about everything, from committee assignments and chairmanships to whether you're going to have a tough re-election battle. You know, in our country, there are a lot of districts that are quite gerrymandered, where one party controls more than the other party, controls a significant segment of the vote. And so they can decide whether you're going to have a tough primary or not. You have leaders who will hand favors to different members depending on the circumstances. You have committee assignments handed on the basis of a political favoritism rather than merit. So nobody's assigned to any committee on the basis of merit, really. They're assigned on the basis of whether you are going to stick with your own party. And then when you're given a committee assignment, the way they keep you looped into the whole enterprise is they'll bring you a little bill on the House floor. So they'll actually hand you a slip of paper that has dollar amounts on it that tells you how much you have to raise for the party in exchange for your committee assignment. So if they put you on a nice committee, yeah, I know, it's insane. And it's insanely corrupt.
Yes.
If you're put onto a nice committee, let's suppose you're put onto Ways and Means or some committee that Energy and Commerce, one of these high-end committees, they will hand you a bill, regardless of what committee you're on, but those are the ones that are the people want the most. They'll come to you on the House floor and they'll hand you a bill that says how much you need to raise for the party. And it's pretty disgusting. And it'll be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, you want to be on this high-end committee? Well, you're going to have to bring in $500,000 for the party, or $750,000 for the party, or maybe even $1 million for the party. And then they have meetings every few weeks where they get together and literally people come to the microphone and brag about how much they've raised for the party in exchange for whatever assignment they got. You know, they got to be on this committee and they come to the microphone and they'll say to the leader of the party, Mr. Speaker or Mr. Leader, I've got a check for you for $1 million for the party, or $2 million. that they've raised for the party. And this is in exchange for official duties. It's totally corrupt. And that's why I have broken away from the party system. I want people to understand what's going on. It's very hard to speak as freely when you're within the party, you know, because you have friends who are around you, you deal with these people on a daily basis, and there are things that, even for someone who's been as outspoken and independent as I've been, I was the most independent Republican in the House when I was a Republican, but it's still hard every day to say the things you want to say without stepping on everyone's toes and making everyone you see every day upset. So the best thing, in my opinion, was to break from the parties, to say, I've had it with these parties. I'm leaving the party system. I'm going to be an independent. I'm going to try to set an example. And hard to say how things got to this place. One of the main reasons it continues is because of all the animosity we have for each other. All of this tension and anger and animosity helps create this system. If you believe that one party is evil and the other party is good, you are contributing to the problem. Both parties sometimes do good things and very often do bad things. And we need to understand that as a people and learn to listen to each other and respect each other. Whether the person supports Donald Trump or doesn't support Donald Trump, or supports Republicans or supports Democrats or whatever it might be, we need to learn to listen to each other and respect each other. And not assume that because someone has a different political position or political opinion or a different party, that the person is a bad person. And if we can do that, we can set an example that trickles up to Congress. This is the only way I know to really fix it, is that the people have to speak out. The people have to start respecting each other so that we set an example for people in Washington, D.C. Because they get feedback from people at home, of course. And what they tend to see time and again, because the loudest voices tend to be the most partisan ones as well, they tend to see a population that is very split, very divided. And I don't think most Americans are like that. I think most Americans are pretty kind to each other, are good people. We work together. And I don't think most Americans are really all that tied to one person, or like, whether it's the president or Nancy Pelosi or whoever it might be. I don't think most people are all that tied to one person or one party. We need to set an example for people at the top so that, you know, in government, so that they know that we are not what's represented on Twitter and social media and Facebook. We're not all hostile to each other. We respect each other. We respect different opinions. We need to make those changes in our own lives. And I'm trying to do that by setting an example for everyone with my work. You'll see that the way I operate, I want to persuade people. If I have a different opinion, I'll try to persuade people. I'll do it respectfully. If you don't agree with me on things, that's okay. Nobody's going to agree with everyone on everything. My family doesn't agree with me on everything. I'm sure if you're married, you'll find your spouse does not agree with you on everything. Your kids will not agree with you on everything. That's the way life is. And you shouldn't expect anything different from representatives in Congress. You should expect that they're not going to agree with you on everything. So whether you agree with me 90% of the time or 30% of the time, the point is, I think it's important to be respectful. I think it's important that I do that. I work to persuade people of my positions if I have a different position, and that we all try to persuade each other and talk to each other respectfully. And I also think it's important that we spend time talking to people who have different opinions. Yeah, because I'll go to town hall sometimes and people will say, well, everyone I know thinks, you know, Trump is awful, or everyone I know thinks he's the greatest ever. And if that's the case, then you need to try speaking to more people and get a feel for what's actually going on in our community and throughout the district. You know, there are people with different opinions, and let's try to talk to each other respectfully and learn about our differences. With that, let me just open it up. It's a pretty small group here today, so.
Yeah, normally you don't fix something by leaving it, but in any case, how are you going to change power of Pelosi, McConnell, and Pelosi as an independent? I mean, you've explained everything, and I understand what's going on. I know all the stuff is going on, and I agree that it's bad, but you can't change by being on the outside. I'm wondering how as an independent you're going to be able to take over Pelosi's power, McConnell's power, and the president's power by being an independent.
Yeah, so the only people who can change Congress are you. That's it. You can't be changed from within. I worked within the parties for about 8.5 years in Congress, and I was in the state legislature as well for 2 years. So I worked within the Republican Party and did try to change it. And so did a lot of my colleagues. We tried hard to open up the process. In fact, although it has a totally different connotation today, the House Freedom Caucus was started with the express purpose of opening up the process. It was not started, contrary to what people might believe, as a conservative group. Nor was it started as a group to defend a president when he's engaged in executive overreach. It wasn't designed for those reasons. It wasn't started for those reasons. It was started as a group to open up the process. We tried these things. They ended up failing every time. And the reason they failed is because the system is too rigid. These problems are too ingrained within Washington. And you're dealing with a relatively small number of people. You're talking about 435 members of the House. And it's really not that hard for a Speaker of the House or a leader of a party to capture these members. The only way it's going to change is if people on the outside are engaged and if they see someone like me who's setting an example. So suppose, for example, I run for re-election in the district and I win by a good margin. That really sends a message to Washington. That's just an example. But the kind of support I can get throughout the district sends a message. The support people show for independent candidates sends a message, whether it's me or someone else. I think only people at home can really send the message to Washington that things need to change. It's not going to change on its own. And all of these things, you know, people say, well, you're not going to be on the committee that you were on before because, you know, you lose your committee assignment when you leave the party. You're not going to be working within the party. But it's important to note what I said earlier, which is that none of these things, in terms of influence, none of them really matter. Everyone is captured over there. So whether you're on a particular committee or whether you're working within a party, they're all captured. The only people who have real power are the people at the very top. And those people, there's like a hierarchy. There's a line of succession. You already know who's going to be next in line. It's all set up. I could have told you from 10 years ago, I could have told you that Kevin McCarthy was likely to be in the position he's in now, where he's the leader of the Republicans. It's sad that I could see it from 10 years ago, and it's certainly not because he's like a particularly talented person. He's not. He's been good at towing the party line and doing what's necessary to pump up the party. You know, he goes around, he travels around, he raises money for people. But in terms of legislation or upholding the Constitution or setting a good policy agenda, he's none of those things. It's very top down, and only you will break it. And the only way you will break it is if there's some kind of tag team between all of us. So I'm doing my part, you do your part. And then we can break the system.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Ron Bieber, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care. Whatever happened to the life that we once knew?